Whether we're talking about foster children, the elderly, or even people being fined court fees, state and human service agencies are partnering with private companies that use them to increase state revenue. That's what Daniel Hatcher says in his new book, The Poverty Industry.
These benefits, they belong to the children, so the children could be using their own resources to plan for their future transition out of foster care, which is a struggle.
That's Hatcher on KERA. Congressman Danny Davis is working on legislation to change the laws on this regarding foster children. We'll speak with him about this issue. Later, we still don't really have a budget, but after 406 days, the budget beard. Peoria Journal Star reporter Chris Kjærgaard's statement on our budget impasse is gone.
Wow. Not used to this. Not used to this at all.
Chris joins us for our regular Monday morning Illinois political roundup. That's all this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Nyla Boodoo, welcome to the 21st. I hope everyone had a great weekend. Today on the program, a New York social worker accused of stealing more than $16,000 of Social Security benefits she took from one of her foster children in her care could face felony charges and up to 7 years in prison. But states taking benefits and money that belong to individual foster children is a common practice, so much so that there are companies that help them figure out how to get even more federal revenue from these children, whether that's through Social Security payments, child support, or even survivor benefits. These are among all of the things detailed by University of Baltimore law professor Daniel Hatcher, whose new book is called The Poverty Industry, The Exploitation of America's Most Vulnerable Citizens. How much money are we talking about? According to the Congressional Research Service for Foster Children, $258 million a year when we're looking specifically at Social Security benefits. And here's the thing, very little of this is against the law. Daniel Hatcher helped Illinois Congressman Danny Davis draft legislation that would stop this. Later, Illinois Congressman Davis will be joining us to discuss what he's proposing. Tomorrow, both of them are taking part in an event in Washington to discuss this issue. But Daniel Hatcher joins us now from Maryland. Daniel, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hello, and thank you so much for having me on the show.
I should mention to our audience, as Daniel and I are talking, you're always welcome to join us with questions and comments. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. Again, that's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show. Daniel, I started with that example that you use of a social worker in New York, because when we think of an individual doing this, we think of it as a crime. But you write about how this is a routine thing for agencies and for state governments to do.
Right, and I think that's a good comparison. You know, in that story out of New York, you had a social worker who was found to have essentially stolen survivor benefits from a foster child. And this was a child who had actually been adopted. So it was a former biological parent who had died. A parent worked, paid into the system, earned a survivor benefit that belonged to the child. And then an adoptive parent was conserving those monies for the child so the child would have the money for the future, whether it be for college or the future transition to independence. About $16,000, unfortunately, the adoptive parent died of cancer. So it's hard to think of a more, you know, breach of trust when you have a social worker then who actually took those conserved funds from a child after an adoptive parent dies of cancer. So that criminal charges were brought in that county. But that very county that was pursuing that individual then was engaged working with revenue contractors to itself look for survivor benefits from children in its care. And then the county was taking those benefits from children in its care. But no one has been up in arms, you know, out of concern in terms of what's happening to those children when the state or the county is taking their money.
Right. And this goes into how quickly parental rights are terminated. There's lots of different benefits that we're talking about, Social Security benefits. Can you explain how all of these different benefits work in terms of how the state can apply for them and how, as you say, they use these children as a source of funds?
Sure. And, you know, there's several different layers to this, depending on the type of benefit we're talking about. Medicaid is often used as well in some states where some states are diverting those funds from intended purpose, intended to help the vulnerable, but rather diverting them to general state coffers. With this particular practice of survivor benefits and disability benefits under the Social Security Administration, you have states and their foster care agencies looking to maximize the number of children determined disabled or to find children who have deceased parents. When they, for example, try to increase the number of kids who are determined disabled in the system, I found contract documents out of Maryland where they're trying to increase that percentage from the initial about 2% of the population to upwards to 15 to 20% of the population determined disabled to claim disability benefits, not to provide any additional services for those disabling conditions, but so the state can take the money as a state savings. The state does that because after they apply for the benefits on the child's behalf, then the state seeks to become the representative payee, which is a fiduciary role. They're supposed to only act in the best interest of that individual foster child, but instead the state is taking the money. And you mentioned earlier about legality. I actually argue that this is an illegal practice that has yet to be fully litigated throughout the courts in this country, but I think it's a direct conflict with fiduciary obligation when you have a state acting in that way.
Let's talk about Illinois. In particular, you have research and documentation that shows, I think you have some information from around 2013 that shows in that year alone, there were about $16 million that the state was using for revenue that should have gone directly back to foster children. Is that accurate?
That's right. So there were some notices of contracts, both new contracts and existing contracts, and part of the explanation in those documents was showing that the state was, at that point, and it looks like still is, taking around $16 million annually from foster children. And this was a focus on disability benefits, so there could be likely even more regarding survivor benefits. And then some states will even take more than that. Some states will take veterans assistance benefits if a child's parent has died in the military. I found an example out of Nebraska where the state crafted a regulation to even allow it to take a burial plot if a child happens to have that in their assets. But so in Illinois, you know, the argument would be from the state is that the state is paying for the cost of foster care, and it costs money to provide foster care services, but that's a legal obligation. The state is legally obligated to provide for the care of abused and neglected children. And most states, most of that funding actually comes from the federal government. It's shared between the federal government and the states. So states are legally obligated to provide that care. Foster children have no legal debt obligation to pay for their own foster care, and I think that's correct, right? You know, they didn't decide to put themselves and foster care, so they shouldn't have to pay for their own care. But that's what the states are essentially doing by taking the children's own funds. And it's a huge missed opportunity as well, because it's not just harm for taking this cash benefit from the children, but it's taking the potential for a planning process, right? You know, you have this money that belongs to the child's own money, that could be used in a process to plan for that child's future transition out of foster care. And kids in foster care, unfortunately, are not doing well when they leave care. I mean, the foster kids suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder at twice the level of Iraq war veterans. They need more help. They don't need us to use them as a revenue source.
And just to be clear, when the children are 18 and if they leave foster care, does that money then get routed back to them?
Well, state by state, it varies depending on the age of which children age out of foster care. If it is a state where the child leaves care at age 18, hopefully that the Social Security Administration should then find a different representative payee that would then preserve those funds for the kids. Or if the child turns 18, the child then might no longer even need a representative payee. But the concern is, you know, all that money before, while the child is in foster care, the state's taking, you know, and it's actually not from the state's perspective. It's not a huge amount of money in terms of the amount of dollars the state will spend on foster care services. But for the kids, it's a huge impact on them. And I think, like, when we're talking about survivor benefits and the example you mentioned earlier, it's not just the cash benefit, but it's an emotional connection. You know, these are benefits that a parent worked, paid into the system and earned for a child. And if that parent dies, you know, the child can not just have the money, but have that connection to a deceased parent that the child can then use to benefit themselves.
I'm speaking with Daniel Hatcher. He's the author of The Poverty Industry, The Exploitation of America's Most Vulnerable Citizens. We're talking in particular about Illinois, but he details lots of different things in the book nationally, lots of different states and how they do this. If you have questions or comments, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. Daniel, I wonder how you think people should look at child welfare agencies, the people who decide if children should go into foster care, because you argue in your book that this economic relationship really has a lot of ramifications for things like parental rights and even child support and other decisions.
Right. And I like to start out by saying I think the vast majority of frontline caseworkers want to do the best work that they can on behalf of their clients. They're trying hard. They're often overworked, underpaid, underappreciated. Most of these, when you're seeing the revenue strategies, that's happening much higher up at the leadership level of the agencies, or sometimes beyond at the state level. But there definitely are fiscal concerns, fiscal incentives built into the structure of funding. Foster care agencies, state foster care agencies, only receive federal funds under what's called Title IV-E of the Social Security Act, which is the main funding structure from the federal government to states to assist with foster care services. They only receive those benefits for a child if a child is taken from a poor family, right, not from a better-off family. That's a deep concern and something I think needs to be addressed at the federal level. There's also concerns that you mentioned with terminating parental rights, that there's federal laws and in which how states have implemented them, where the agencies will often rush towards terminating parental rights even if there's not an adoptive resource lined up for a child, because it can have a financial incentive to do so.
And as you mentioned, this doesn't just occur with foster children. You were talking about Medicaid matching funds. There's an example you used of Michigan that I wanted to talk about, but before we get to that, can you explain first how Medicaid matching funds work for states?
Sure. So as you described, Medicaid is a matching grant program. It's shared financing between the federal government and the states. And Maryland is a 50-50 match state. Illinois, I believe, is pretty close to that as well. So in Maryland, where I live, if Maryland spends $50 on Medicaid-eligible services for a low-income individual or child, then the state could also receive $50 in matching funds from the federal government. So then you're intended to have $100 total, right, for those Medicaid services for the low-income individual.
Right, and then you use the example of Michigan and how from 1996 to 1999, the state actually diverted $106 million in federal Medicaid funds intended for school children. How did they do that?
Well, and this is an example of what's happening in multiple states where, first, sometimes there's an illusory process in how the funds are claimed, where it's supposed to be state spending that occurs in order to trigger the federal match of additional federal dollars. But sometimes the states will sort of move money around through an illusory process where there is no actual state spending, but then they'll claim the federal Medicaid dollars. Now, what's most concerning to me then is what then the states do with the federal Medicaid dollars to make sure that they're actually spending that money to help the vulnerable populations as intended. And you're discussing an example where sometimes, unfortunately, that money has been diverted rather than for the intended purpose of serving the vulnerable with Medicaid services, using that money instead, diverting it to general state coffers. I talk about an example out of New Jersey that's happening still right now where the state forces school districts in New Jersey to work with a revenue contractor to maximize the number of school-based Medicaid claims. And these are monies that are intended for low-income disabled school kids to help provide for special education services, you know, huge need for these children. But the state then, right as its own budget documents, will take over 80% of that money intended for poor disabled school kids and route it to general state coffers.
How did you get involved with all of this research to begin with?
Good question. My very first job was legal aid work almost 20 years ago. I was representing children in the Baltimore foster care system. I had a huge caseload. It was overwhelming to me in terms of what I saw that the kids were going through, both in foster care and the struggles as they were leaving foster care. And through my work representing children and then also impoverished adults, I started to encounter practices that deeply concerned me, where you had states and agencies that are supposed to be existing for the public welfare, especially for the vulnerable, were actually putting their own fiscal state interest over those that they were intended to serve. And the first example I discovered was this example of states taking resources from foster children.
And Daniel, your research in the book, you conclude Indiana, Kentucky, Ohio, Wisconsin, New Jersey, your home state, Maryland. How did you get all of this information?
I received much of the information through state public records requests, Freedom of Information Act requests, in particular regarding state contract documents, working with contractors to help obtain disability and survivor benefits from children. Some of the other information I found through case records, some of the information is just online. You know, it's pretty striking how bold some states are in their diversion of federal aid intended for the vulnerable. There's an example out of New Hampshire where the state was using an illusory Medicaid scheme to maximize Medicaid funds intended for the poor, and then had a general revenue line item called Medicaid Enhancement Revenue. So it was taking that Medicaid, the federal Medicaid funds intended for the poor, instead using it for general state revenue. In the first year that the state did that in New Hampshire, I believe it was 26 or 28% of the total state revenue.
I'm speaking with Daniel Hatcher. He's the author of The Poverty Industry, The Exploitation of America's Most Vulnerable Citizens. Daniel, we're going to take a break in about a minute, but really quickly, I just wanted to ask you about, basically, this is kind of comes down to a policy argument, right? Is redirecting this revenue for children necessary because the revenue wouldn't exist otherwise?
I think that's a great question. And first, I don't think foster children should have to pay for their own care, right? Then they're not legally obligated to do so. States are cash-strapped. Their agencies are cash-strapped. But when states use the vulnerable populations that they're supposed to serve, instead use them as a revenue source, harm results. And it turns the mission away from its intended mission. You know, the mission for these foster care agencies is supposed to be protecting the best interests of children in their care, not taking their money.
When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Daniel Hatcher. Congressman Danny Davis is also going to be joining us to talk about how he's dealing with this issue. You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned.
The library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, showing and preserving significant collections and digitally archiving irreplaceable information so that it is forever accessible to students, faculty, and the community at large. The University Library at Illinois.
Nyla Boodoo, welcome back to The 21st. We're talking to Daniel Hatcher. He's a University of Baltimore law professor. He's the author of The Poverty Industry, The Exploitation of America's Most Vulnerable Citizens. In particular, we've been talking about the foster care system, foster children, the benefits that are owed them, how they're claimed by the state and used for revenue. And how much money are we talking about? Well, nationwide, if we're talking about foster children and some supplemental security benefits, the Congressional Research Service says that's $258 million a year for supplemental security income. Congressman Danny Davis is working on legislation that would change that. And tomorrow at the Carnegie Library in Washington, D.C., he's participating in a forum on this. Daniel Hatcher will also be there as a panelist. Congressman Davis, of course, has represented Illinois' 7th District in and around Chicago, and he's joining us on the line from there. Congressman Davis, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you very much. It's indeed a pleasure.
Congressman Davis, this is, I think, for imagine many people, probably disturbing to hear about foster children in particular and how the state is using and redirecting revenue. When were you first aware of this as an issue?
Well, I think we became aware some time ago. As a matter of fact, to some degree, former Representative Stark had raised the issue and had also proposed some legislation. But I think what's going on right now is very refreshing. There seemed to be a tremendous amount of interest and advocacy emerging and taking place in Congress, among members of Congress, who are taking on this issue of the welfare of foster youth, homeless youth, what's happening with those young people who don't have the same opportunities to grow and develop as young people who just live in stable two-family homes with loving, caring parents. And quite frankly, it's heartwarming for me to see the kind of interest that is emerging and developing.
Well, Congressman Davis, you're helping draft legislation that would limit and stop the practice of foster care agencies taking all of their resources. It would include new savings accounts. We were just talking to Daniel Hatcher about the loss of income these children are seeing up until 18, where they're sort of left when they transition out of the foster care system without much resources. What would your legislation do?
Well, what it would do is make sure that as much of the resource as possible got directly into the use of the foster youth themselves. I mean, some agencies and some units of government, and not only as it relates to foster youth and individuals with disabilities, but others for whom they sometimes, for example, I get complaints all the time from some senior citizens or some people who live in nursing home situations or who live independently but have some entity managing their resources, who feel that they don't get the direct benefit of all that is coming to them. And we've discovered and know that some states, when this money comes in, or when the resource is available, they use it for whatever they need.
Yeah, you know,
if it can plug a little bit of a hole, or if it can do something else, they'll do that, when in actuality, it should be going directly to the young person for whom it's designed to go to.
You know, thanks for mentioning that, Congressman Davis. Daniel Hatcher, I wonder if you could weigh in on, he mentioned elderly residents, and I know you write about in the book in Indiana how the Health and Human Hospital Corporation in Marion County in Indianapolis, what they have done with the elderly nursing home population and patients. Can you explain how the county set up a corporation in terms of doing this with funding, particularly for elderly
that's
patients?
That's my book.
Oh, no. Daniel Hatcher's on the line with us as well, Congressman.
There's another Dan.
Yeah, no, sorry. This is Daniel Hatcher. He's on the line with us as well, Congressman.
Okay.
Yeah. Daniel, if you could weigh in.
Sure, and it's wonderful to be on the call with Congressman Davis. So, and I agree with the Congressman's comments about the need to protect these children's funds. I mean, these are the children's own monies that could be used to help themselves, for their struggle as they age out of foster care. And as states are so cash-strapped and have been unwilling, both blue states and red states have been unwilling to raise sufficient revenue through general taxation, I think, unfortunately, you've seen examples where they've looked for money elsewhere through these sort of behind-the-scenes mechanisms that are awfully hidden from the public. The issue regarding nursing homes, so unfortunately often the elderly poor have been used in some of these revenue schemes as well. And nursing homes are not doing well on average in this country in terms of the quality of care that's provided. You know, Illinois is one of the states that, you know, through some of the grading reports that are out there, has received an F grade in terms of quality of care of nursing homes. Indiana has received low grades like that as well. The example I found out of Indianapolis that I write about in the book is where the Health and Hospital Corporation, which is a municipal agency that runs the hospital and health system in Indianapolis, started buying up for-profit nursing homes, not just close to Indianapolis, but corner to corner all around the state of Indiana. And then once they became, you know, government-owned, although what they're actually doing is buying the licenses and often hiring sometimes the very same companies to keep running the nursing homes. But once they were considered government-owned, they could trigger higher Medicaid reimbursement rate from the federal government. which is good if you're getting more resources to serve low-income residents of nursing homes. But then, unfortunately, what was happening is that municipal agency out of Indianapolis was diverting those funds to other purposes, used it to build a multi-million dollar hospital system in Indianapolis. Now, at least there is used for a healthcare purpose, but that's not how it's intended, right? These are Medicaid funds that were intended to help provide better services for the elderly, which in Indiana have been languishing in poor care.
And if I might, that's one of the reasons why I say it is so refreshing to have this interest emerge and get projected, because the population groups that we're talking about oftentimes don't have the same resources nor ability to advocate for their causes the way that, say, a major corporation that's got money to spend to hire lobbyists and so on and so on, so are other kinds of interests who do the same thing. And we know that the mix of making public decisions is so great. I mean, there are so many things that we need to do. And if your issue does not get on the table, chances are then, you know, you're left out. If you're not part of the meal, then for the meal.
Well, and I wanted to ask you all, Daniel Hatcher, in your book, you wrote about the Foster Children Self-Support Act. Congressman Davis, that was Representative Stark's bill that had tried to resolve this when we're talking about this for foster children. And that was, I think, back in 07 and 2010 that was trying to be introduced. I imagine that both of you will be facing a lot of opposition from private industry and from the agencies themselves, who argue that they don't have a source of revenue apart from what they have. Congressman Davis, what's your response to agencies when they say that to you?
Well, I think the agencies will certainly want to try and protect the positions that they have carved out. But that doesn't really bother me. It doesn't bother me because the agencies are not the people who elect me. I mean, I'm elected to advocate on behalf of those individuals that I think have the greatest amount of need and fit that in with the overall mix. And since I know that foster children can't advocate as well for themselves as some others can advocate a position, then that's where I stake out my position. That's where I stake out my claim. And I'll be advocating for them.
Daniel Hatcher, I wonder if you can explain a little bit about, there's a couple private companies that you mentioned that have contracts often nationwide to work on these. I mean, those are also, and some of them, in the case of one company you mentioned, Maximus, that's a publicly traded company. It's a for-profit industry.
That's right. You can buy stock in a company, I believe. And Maximus has had contracts. And in Illinois, I believe that the contract most recently to help the state obtain survivor and disability benefits, in particular disability benefits, from foster children has been with another company by the name of the Public Consulting Group. So you have, not all states have entered into contracts with these revenue contractors yet to help with this practice, but it's an increasing number of states who are. And then so the companies will help the states, again, the foster care agencies, seek out children, either to increase the number of children who are disabled or to look for children who have dead parents in order to then claim their benefits, in order to help the state take over control of that money as by becoming representative payee, which, again, is supposed to be a fiduciary obligation, right, where that state is supposed to only protect the best interests of those children. And then the state, unfortunately, takes the money. And I have to say, you know, at the end of the day with those revenue contracts, I've been concerned about some of the language that I've seen in contract documents. A document out of Maryland, an assessment report from Maximus, described foster children as a revenue-generating mechanism, right? You know, that's concerning to me when it's focused on money rather than the best interests of the kids. But at the end of the day, it's the state leaders, it's the governors, it's the head of the state human service agencies who are deciding then how to use those funds. right? So the head of the state agency in Illinois could decide right now that we're going to actually use the children's money to help them as it's intended to be used. These are monies that belong to the kids. The governor could do that well. So this is happening at the leadership level of the state.
And I don't have any problem at all with the states trying to collect every dime that should come into the state, but use it for the benefit of the children, if that is what it was collected for and designed for. So I'm not trying to keep private industry and private businesses from having a role and a function, but let's just use it for what it was intended.
I should mention to our audience, the Public Consulting Group and Maximus, our staff at the 21st did reach out to both companies before we went to air, and we did not get a response from them before airtime because they knew we were doing this segment. Congressman Davis, do you have bipartisan support on this legislation?
Well, we generally end up with a bit. It's not as easy right now in some instances to generate bipartisan relationships because of the fact that there is an election coming up in November. And no matter what else goes on in our country, we do have the competitiveness of political parties who believe that the country would be better served or best served if they are in office. And so we keep working, and we've continued to work with members of the opposite party, with Republican members of Congress. Every bill that I've ever gotten passed generally had some support. And so I expect that we'll be able to generate support. How much between now and the end of the election cycle? I mean, that kind of remains to be seen.
That's Congressman Danny Davis. He represents Illinois' 7th District in and around Chicago, where he had joined us now. Congressman Davis, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Well, thank you both. I am delighted, and I certainly thank you, and I thank the Dan for his advocacy position, the great research, and the great work that he's done. We need it.
Congressman,
thank you very much for your leadership, Congressman.
I was going to say, both of you, Daniel Hatcher and Congressman Danny Davis, are participating in a forum on this at the Carnegie Library in Washington, D.C. tomorrow. Daniel Hatcher's book is called The Poverty Industry, The Exploitation of America's Most Vulnerable Citizens. A comment we just got from Sheena on Facebook: I'm a foster parent of two lovely kids. Thank you so much for shining a light on these shenanigans by lawmakers. I am hopeful for their futures because people are stepping up to protect them. You can always join our conversation. Search for the 21st on Facebook. Like us there, and you can join us there. Stay tuned. We'll be coming up. We'll be continuing our conversation in just a few minutes, looking at Illinois politics. Coming up on the 21st, it's our regular Monday politics segment. We'll be joined by the Peoria Journal Star's Chris Kjærgaard. He actually shaved his budget beard after 406 days, even though there hasn't been a budget impasse. He'll be joined by IPR's Amanda Vinicky. You can always reach us, as I said, on Facebook. You can search for the 21st at www.21stshow.org. It's also got all the ways to email, call, and contact us. You can find our Twitter handle and how you can get podcasts there as well. Stay tuned. You're listening to the 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in today. On Mondays, we talk state politics. This week, a state lawmaker is getting creative paying his bills. Senator Kirk trails Representative Tammy Duckworth in the money race for his U.S. Senate seat. And the budget beard is gone. We're going to get to that later. Joining us on the line, Amanda Vinicky is a State House Bureau Chief for Illinois Public Radio, and she's taking time out of her day off to talk with us. Thanks, Amanda.
But of course, my pleasure.
Chris Kjærgaard covers politics for the Peoria Journal-Star, and he's on the line from Peoria. Hey, Chris, welcome back to the 21st.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about our first story here, guys. State lawmakers are waiting in line to get paid, like the many others who are owed money from the state, as we've been detailing, whether it's a social service agency or others. State Representative Chad Hayes is a Republican from the 104th District. Amanda, he asked to borrow money from his campaign fund?
Yeah, you know, campaign funds are generally far more plentiful than a lot of legislators. Well, of course, there are some wealthy legislators that may not be the case for. But if you're, you know, hard up for cash, it's one of those things where I think you'll have some voters and, as you noted, social service providers, companies that have had to lay off people, not feeling much sympathy for legislators for not getting the job done with a budget for so long. And that caused them to make some really tough choices, take out loans, for example. I think you could find some legislators who probably had to do that, though, when in April, the comptroller announced that she was going to, it's not that they're not getting paid, it's just that legislators' paychecks go on this big pile of bills that the state doesn't have money to pay up front, and so it takes a while. So they did actually just get paid for April, but obviously we're in July, so they're missing the paychecks that would typically have come in May and June.
Amanda or Chris, I'm not sure which either of you want to jump in here, but around how much are lawmakers paid?
Just shy of $60,000 a year, $70,000 a year is the base salary. It's about 67.5, 67.8, something along those lines. But of course, the vast majority of them end up making more than that with their leadership supplements if they serve as either a chairperson of a committee or a spokesperson on a committee, which means essentially everybody who's been there for two terms or more ends up making a bump of some kind.
And does he
I was just going to say, they can use their campaign funds, for example. There are restrictions. There didn't used to be back in the day, but Illinois, as it has tried to get more ethics laws on the books, has implemented some restrictions. Nonetheless, let's say a legislator is in Springfield. They can use their campaign fund to go out to dinner. So, you know, it's not as if they can use it for anything, which is why Representative Chad Hayes needed to ask for permission to take out a loan that playing it safe. But yeah, I mean, if a legislator were hungry, make it a campaign event and bring some folks out to dinner, that'd count.
Amanda, who do they have to ask for permission from?
State Board of Elections.
All right. Because it's campaign money, so they're supposed to kind of over the... Can we get back to, I think this might be helpful for people to understand. We know that there is a stopgap budget deal. We know that money is flowing somewhat. We know there's a backlog. Amanda, how does this happen? Where does the line of what's the priority of who gets paid? Who's figuring that out? And is money how quickly is money getting to people?
Well, it can get to people. So, again, legislators actually just last week got paid their April paychecks, if that gives you any sort of indication. But there is a lot that goes into it. You could have a comptroller making a decision to pay a group when it calls or writes a letter and says, hey, I'm really hard up. I'm going to have to go out of business if you don't pay me soon. And so she could put that at the top of this, you know, imaginary pile. But there could also be a symbolic pile, I guess, not imaginary, because it's most definitely there and it's been building for a while because Illinois just doesn't have the money to pay its revenues. There could also be a court that says you need to pay this line first. That's where when we talk about all of the court orders that have kept Illinois really, in a sense, running even throughout the impasse. those would go toward the top of the list. Anything where state law, when you, you know, pension payments, that would be at the top of the list. So some of it is her discretion. Some of it is through judicial order. And that's really where you get this list. But in cases, Nyla, I mean, it's a year. When you talk, for example, about state employees and their health insurance, a lot of doctors and dentists in the capital city require upfront payment from patients. And then the patients have to wait a year or so to get reimbursed straight up from the insurance company because the insurers or the doctors, pardon me, has said no more. We're not waiting a full year to be paid because they're lower on that total.
Right. And I was going to mention some of those are still waiting longer. We're actually going to be talking about that, particularly in regards to dentists on the 21st later on this week. But Amanda, that brings to mind with dentists, I know dentists and doctors, they had to be paid back with a 9% interest rate. Is the state paying back interest now for other people as well?
Well, it's all by law. So there are some entities, yes, that do get interest and others that don't. That's where also there's been the news about former Governor Jim Edgar, pardon me, being one of a handful of companies that will basically pay up front a social service vendor or small business that is waiting for money from the state, and then they make money off of that interest. So if you can hold on these entities.
Yeah, Amanda, it sounds like we're having a little problems with your line there. Chris, let me ask you something.
Ooh,
it's okay. The number of state workers who make more than $100,000 a year is down slightly. I wonder that we saw some of that data out today. Are those numbers significant, the amount of state workers who are making above a six-figure salary?
Well, the symbolism on that is really the most significant part. And I've talked to several state employees who have told me that there's a good deal of caution that goes into some of the positions they take, particularly those of them who may have political aspirations, because they worry about crossing over that threshold and ending up on those lists. But it is significant, I would say, that there's been a decline in those, and it's reflective of several things, including something of a brain drain of longstanding folks who, for one reason or another, have chosen to get out of state government, take retirement, and are not actively working and making those salaries anymore. And yes, some of it also comes from what the governor's office noted in Doug Finke's article this weekend in the State Journal Register with regard to a more cautious management on overtime in some areas, particularly corrections.
Let's switch to national politics. I'm speaking with Amanda Vinicky. She's the State House Bureau Chief for Illinois Public Radio. On the line with us from Peoria and the Journal Star is Chris Kergard. He covers politics as well. I wanted to talk about the race between the Senate seat race between incumbent Mark Kirk and his challenger, Democratic Representative Tammy Duckworth. Senator Kirk has a new ad out accusing her of spending taxpayers' money to fend off a lawsuit. Can you guys remind people what's behind that? Amanda?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So the lawsuit goes back to when Duckworth worked for Rod Blagojevich. And I really, you have seen, it's been striking to me this entire campaign, really, where you get press releases every day. And it seems to me to be very little about substance on either end. The only press release that you get from the Duckworth campaign is attempting to tie Mark Kirk to Donald Trump in the hopes that that will make him unpopular with moderate voters. And then Kirk trying to really make a big issue out of this court case that has now been settled. He's saying taxpayer dollars were used when really it is typical for the attorney general to defend this sort of suit, given that it was when Duckworth worked for the state.
Chris, how are they looking in?
And it's a whistleblower case, really.
Right.
And let me just add that. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. No. Thanks for that. Chris, what are we looking like in terms of this race right now? Is it looking like it's a close race between Senator Kirk and Tammy Duckworth, Representative Duckworth?
It certainly viewed, particularly at the national level, as a race that is one that could very well flip party control. Between Republican and Democrat, it's certainly viewed as a close race there. But I have to agree with Amanda that there's been precious little substance to the race so far, and certainly from a downstate perspective, very little attention paid by either candidate to anything outside of Chicagoland, either during the primary or now that we've entered the general election. I understand that that's likely to change once we get into August and both candidates are on the congressional recess. I expect we'll be seeing much more of both of them downstate. And the challenge will be to get them off their message, which is exactly as Amanda said, the Duckworth camp trying to tie Senator Kirk with Mark, Senator Kirk with Donald Trump, and the Kirk folks trying to resurrect this lawsuit, even though it's been settled. It's not issue based at all, and they really have not discussed much about anything of Illinois interest.
Well, and in fact, we should point out that in fact, presumptive Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump and called Senator Kirk, I think, was it an idiot last week? Was that the exact phrase that he used, Amanda? You can correct me if I'm wrong on that.
I'm trying to remember. I don't have it in front of me, but you're right. It was, and it's one of those things where that could actually, I mean, if you believe what clearly has to have been poll tested for Duckworth in terms of why they're trying to tie Kirk with Trump, if anything, Trump's accusations against Kirk could work in his favor in a state like Illinois. You did have Kirk being really one of the first, if not really the first, elected U.S. senator that came out and said he wouldn't be voting for Trump. And now you have the Duckworth campaign trying to say, well, look, he wants Petraeus now. That's what Kirk has said. He's going to write in former General Petraeus as his pick for U.S. president. So it is certainly been interesting. No love lost there, evidently.
I wanted to ask you guys, switch topics a little bit, and ask about reaction last week. Former Illinois Congressman Joe Walsh. I'm being told that actually it wasn't that he was actually, the term was loser, not idiot. So just
there we go.
Accuracy.
All the difference.
Right. Now everyone knows. Former Illinois Congressman Joe Walsh. The tweet he sent out last week after the shootings in Dallas Thursday night, getting national news, lots of people talking about what he said. I'm just going to paraphrase what he said, essentially that President Obama should watch out and that real America was coming after him. And then, of course, he deleted it. But he also said that he told Sarah Burnett at the AP he wasn't calling for violence, but he stood by what he said was his larger message, that he wants people to boycott and to protest and stand with police. I wanted to ask both of you what you've seen in terms of reaction of sort of Joe Walsh kind of reappearing in the political scene. Chris?
I'd have to say that everybody I've heard anything from on that has greeted it with a sigh and an eye roll. Joe Walsh's shtick got very tired very quickly for a number of Illinois Republicans that I've talked to, and I don't know that he was ever taken terribly seriously there for any of his outlandish statements when he was in office, when he was running unsuccessfully for re-election against Tammy Duckworth, or since he's left office and done other work.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I wonder, Amanda, if you think the national media caught on that, because certainly that's been the response in Illinois. Kind of everybody knows Joe Walsh. Do you think the national media has picked up on that, Amanda?
You know, I mean, I think it's one of those stories where those remarks, they get picked up, and he's a former congressman, so it makes sense that it's a story, but it nonetheless won't be any sort of, you know, career resurrection. It's a one-day story of this, of course, very lingering issue in terms of racism, police relations, et cetera, in our country. So notable, a bullet point on this very long list of issues, but I don't expect that it means that Joe Walsh is going to be, you know, getting any sort of renewed attention in Illinois or on the national front, unless, I mean, obviously we can't know how the presidential election is going to play out, who Donald Trump will pluck from obscurity or not. So who knows? But I don't think that we are going to see Walsh at least slated for any positions by the Illinois GOP anytime soon.
We just have a minute left, but Chris, we need to update everybody on the budget beard, because you refused to shave until lawmakers and the budget agreed on the morning. It was only a stopgap temporary fix, but I have to ask, are you clean shaven this morning?
I am clean shaven this morning and feeling wonderful now that that's done. I never bargained on it running 13 plus months.
So it was 406 days, and did you just decide that you could not wait until a full actual budget, that the stopgap impasse would have to suffice at the moment?
Well, the fact that there had to be some serious negotiation and bipartisan work, both of which had been lacking over the previous 13 months, was enough for me. The beard was symbolic of an absence of that as much of a budget, and I think that shaving it was a good way to encourage more of that kind of thing. And we wanted to raise some money for charities.
Yeah, really quickly, Chris, how much did you raise?
We're still getting the numbers in
okay.
on that. I actually had messages from people this morning who still wanted to donate.
Okay, well, and if people still want to donate, we'll tweet that information out, as well as a picture of the clean-shaven Chris Caregard. Thanks to Chris Caregard and Amanda Vinicky for joining us. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, the story of how a North Shore Chicago woman ended up being sent to a facility for teen moms because her family wanted to hide her pregnancy. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening to The 21st.